Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
The precipitating event was that the farmers wanted a state-owned mill. They gave approval, authorized it essentially, and then the legislature said that they wouldn't do it. And so suddenly there was that situation where the political parties were unresponsive even after the people of North Dakota had asked them to do something. And 2 months later, two people who had been members of the Socialist Party organized the Nonpartisan League. And a year later, they took over the state.
And that's how it's done. Get the people to insist on something they want and then make the politicians deliver or leave. Hi, this is Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, welcoming you once again to another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Today we're going to take another look at how the people of North Dakota managed to take on the powers that be 100 years ago to build a legacy of local empowerment and protection of self-interest over and against the large corporate and monopolistic powers of their day and ours. Our guest is David Morris, co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who tells some wonderful stories about how the example of those plains farmers back in the day sets an example for us today as we struggle against the same forces that are eating away at our commonwealth and our public interest. Later, Ellen talks with Alana Hartzog, the founder of the Earth Rights Institute, as they discuss how we've missed the boat in our economic thinking if we leave out the true economic value of the earth and our land. Let's begin with our discussion with David Morris of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which focuses on the primacy of local interests and action.
One of the things about working at the local level, as they say, the local level is where the rubber meets the road, and what is both challenging and enlightening is how one, in fact, makes something happen. I mean, how does one convince them to do something? And, you know, in some ways, unlike the federal level, at the local level, you have scarce resources, and the biggest scarce resource is people. And so you not only have to get someone's attention, but you have to get someone to do something that they're not already doing, which means usually not doing something that they are already doing. And one way to do that is to do the work for them in terms of the research. But then there's the work of sort of lobbying internal to the bureaucracy and the agencies. And so, you know, that tends to be very challenging, especially at the local level. The state level is a little less challenging. I mean, one has to convince them, but they do have those kinds of resources.
Well, you wrote a really interesting piece called How to Make a Political Revolution, and it was based on the story of the Bank of North Dakota, which we talk about pretty regularly. Great stories associated with how these local people took on big powers. Tell us a little bit about, in your view, what were the dynamics that really helped to bring that political revolution about and how it looks today?
Sure. Well, one should recall that this is North Dakota we're talking about in the early 20th century. And it was a state that then had about 600,000 people. It only has maybe 750,000 people now. So if one wants to think about it in terms of the number of people either in your city or in your metropolitan area, or if you live in Vermont or some other small states, the number of people in your state. And essentially what was happening in the late 19th century and early 20th century in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest, was a deep dissatisfaction by farmers about their plight. And in the case of North Dakota, you were talking about a state that was essentially a colony of Minneapolis. Their railroads were owned by a person who lived in St. Paul, and the grain was milled in Minneapolis mills. The grain elevators were owned by Minneapolis grain companies, and the banks were Minneapolis banks that loaned into North Dakota. And so it was a very clear case. One did not have to convince anybody of that situation. And in the late 19th century, you had the populist movement, you had the cooperative movement, and they created new institutional forms in mutual aid and mutual self-help. But what they realized was that they were struggling upstream. They were trying to swim upstream against rules and institutions that had been created that were larger than they. And so they needed to deal with political power. And in the early part of the 20th century, there were two things that happened. One was that they got the direct primary, and that was a progressive revolution and a progressive movement that essentially introduced primaries as a way to bypass the political conventions and the political bosses' domination of politics. And the other thing that they got was a referendum and initiative, and so that people could essentially on their own create laws. And what happened was that the precipitating event was that the farmers wanted a state-owned mill elevator. It's called the terminal elevator, which was an elevator for storage and a mill for processing. And they wanted that, and they had a referendum in which they gave approval, authorized it essentially. And then the legislature in January of 2015 said that they wouldn't do it. And so suddenly there was that situation where the political parties were unresponsive even after the people of North Dakota had asked them to do something. And 2 months later, in March of 2015, two people who had been members of the Socialist Party and had run on the Socialist Party ticket organized the Nonpartisan League. And a year later, they took over the state of and the reason that they could do that, several reasons actually, but one was that they had what was called an open primary. There are open primaries and closed primaries. And in a closed primary, when you go and vote in the Democratic or the Republican primary, you have to be a member of the Democratic and Republican Party. But in an open primary, you do not have to be. And so what that meant is that they could, in March of 2016, they...
Let me just interrupt you. But you mean 1915, right?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Every 100 years, I'm going to make that mistake. Yes, indeed. And so they would have an endorsing convention, and they could endorse Democrats, they could endorse, you know, Republicans, and they did. But the Republican Party was dominant in North Dakota at that time, as they are now. And so they essentially ran their candidates in the Republican primary. And in June of 1916 was the Republican primary, and they essentially took over the Republican Party. And then that November they had elections, and they took over, mostly took over the state of Minnesota.
You mean North Dakota?
They took over the government, and then in 1918 they took over the complete government, every aspect of the government. So one factor in their success was that they had this ability to run independent candidates in party primaries. And the second thing is that they were incredible organizers. The key to organizing in 1915 was a car. And they got a car. They had very little money, but they got a car, and they got to put some gas in the car. You got to understand, 1915, there weren't a whole bunch of gas stations. And that allowed them to get around the state. And they gave speeches just about every day in the state. And they asked for a membership fee. Now, the membership fee that they asked for in 1915 was, and 1916, was $8, well, it was $6, and then it was $8 a year. Now, $6 and $8 a year, the typical farm income at that time was about $400 a year. Hmm. So about 2% of their income they were asking for as a membership fee. And that's a substantial amount of money. And in fact, they made it a substantial amount of money because they said if farmers treated this as an investment, they would stick to it, as opposed to a sort of a trivial fee so that they could be a member of a party. And the third thing that was important was that they had a very clear platform. They did not run on trite phrases. They did not run on social justice and fairness for all. They ran on a platform that contained half a dozen planks, and they were very specific: a Bank of North Dakota, a mill in North Dakota, a elevator in North Dakota, insurance company in North Dakota. And so that's what they ran on. And when they were elected, that was in fact the platform that they implemented. So those three things, I think, are very important for us to know now, you know, 100 years later. And they came to power. They were only in power for 5 years. So people need to know it was a very brief moment, 1916 to 1921, essentially. But in those 5 years, they initially had a referendum in which the people of North Dakota said that their state could become involved in businesses. That was a key constitutional change for the state. They said the state could borrow money. That was a key constitutional change. They said that the state could set up a bank. And since they were government, they immediately did, in fact, set up that bank. They did set up the elevator and the flour mill. And then they broadened the ability of citizens to make their own legislation. I said that they had had referendum and initiative previously, but they expanded it. They made it easier for people to get issues on the ballot, and they added recall. And they were the first state to have recall, which meant essentially that people could recall their elected politicians. And it proved in some ways their Achilles heel. It was democracy sort of gone too far because the opposition, in the process of taking over, they recalled the entire slate, senior slate, if you will, of the Nonpartisan League. And so the opposition came to power in 1921 and immediately put on the ballot new constitutional amendments that would abolish the Bank of North Dakota, that would cut dramatically the amount of borrowing power of the state and so forth. And they had, I believe it was either 8 or 9 ballot initiatives that the legislature put on the ballot. And every one of them was defeated, although very, very narrowly. But they were all defeated. And so, in essence, you had a situation where the people were, for a whole bunch of reasons, sort of upset, if you will, with the Nonpartisan League. But at the same time, they honored the laws that they had passed, and they wanted the institutions that they had created. And so 1916 to 1921, a period of astonishing activity, and then they were thrown out of power. But the institutions that they created continued, and the thinking that, in fact, people could collectively make rules and create institutions that would allow them independence was one that continues to this day. And one of the, I think, important aspects of the Nonpartisan League, it was they sometimes use the term proprietor capitalism. It was capitalism for the little people. It was not socialism in the sense that the state did not own the means of production, but the state did have a public option. That's what we would call it, I think, in 2016, is that you had a Bank of North Dakota, but you had other banks as well. You had a state, a flour mill and an elevator, but you also had private flour mills and elevators. So essentially, the state kept the private sector honest, and it gave people a choice. And that was, you know, essentially what the Nonpartisan League was about. This isn't sure. just something that happened 100 years ago, and that was that. Because in 1932, the citizens of North Dakota decided to ban corporate ownership of farmland. Mm-hmm. And in June of 2016, the citizens overwhelmingly rejected a ballot initiative by the big corporations that would have overturned that 1932 law. In 1963, they passed a law, once again, by referendum and initiative, that essentially banned chain ownership of drugstores. If you own a pharmacy, if you operate a pharmacy in the state of North Dakota, it has to be owned by a state-licensed pharmacist. And so essentially, they do have some chain pharmacies, but those were the ones that were grandfathered in that existed in 1963, but otherwise they do not. And in 2014, and I say that 2014, the citizens overwhelmingly rejected a Walmart and Walgreens financed, handsomely financed, initiative that would have repealed the pharmacy ownership law. But essentially, what happens is that when you have these institutions that are rooted, and when people suddenly realize that these things are working for them, that later on it becomes difficult for entrenched interests, if you will, and the wealthy and the large corporations to undo them. My organization, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, has been involved with a number of battles, if you will, helping the people of North Dakota, and one of them was against the effort to overturn the pharmacy ownership law. And so we worked with the Independent Pharmacy Association in North Dakota, and we provided a basic report that was very helpful in the legislative process, and went there to testify at the legislature. And in the testimony in the legislature by the independent pharmacists, they essentially laid bare their accounting system, and they showed what is the price that they charged for their drugs versus what Walgreens charged for their drugs, and they were lower. And the quality of their services was much higher. The customer satisfaction was enormous. The number of pharmacies in rural areas in North Dakota was dramatically higher than the number of pharmacies in South Dakota, which is a good comparison state. So I think that there's many lessons that we can learn from the Nonpartisan League and not think that it was something, it was an artifact of a certain age and couldn't be done again.
Yeah, a terrifically interesting story and so relevant for today's realities. You quote an observer who would describe them as a large, loose, animated, and untidy, but sure of itself, and it's settled a disallowance of the vested interests. And it sounds like that has been going on for the better part of 100 years.
Yes, but I think it's important to point out that by 1918, and some would say by late 1916, so the figures are not perfectly accurate, they had 40,000 members.
Wow.
They had 40,000 members. Now, this is a state that had only a little over 600,000 in their population. So, you know, that's astounding. One could argue that I think it might have been 60% of all the, or 70% of all the farm households, and they were paying 2% of their income into this. And they did so because they said to themselves, look, I'm a farmer. As a farmer, I know how much more I would get if, in fact, I didn't have to send it to Minneapolis and therefore subtract the transportation cost from the price that I'm getting. And that I know how much I produce and so forth. And so the membership fee was, in fact, an investment where they could calculate what their return would be if they won. And therefore, they wanted to win, and they talked to their neighbors about it. And I think that in 2016, we tend to, in some ways, allow people to identify with movements without some investment. And we promise them things that are relatively general. Now, that's not uniformly the case. Of course, the $15 per hour minimum wage movement has been very concrete and very focused. But I think that when we talk about the political platforms that we might propose, they do tend to be somewhat more amorphous.
Very impressive to see that these people used the local institutions to leverage their freedom and choices in years to come, as opposed to giving up to the market interests that are at play everywhere. The banking industry there, of course, is the same way, isn't it? In North Dakota, there's nowhere else in the country where community banks are thriving the way they are there.
That's exactly right, and I think that, once again, it's important that there was a debate about whether the Bank of North Dakota would be a retail bank. There was a debate about that, and they decided that it would not be, that it would be a wholesale bank, and that, in fact, it would be a bank to enable community banks, but not a bank that would supersede community banks. And you're right at this day. I mean, if you look at North Dakota in terms of, as I mentioned, the independent pharmacies that it has, but if you look at North Dakota in terms of the number of community banks it has and the prosperity of community banks that it has, and I think that some people who are of a certain age right now, meaning young people, might say, well, in North Dakota they've had that oil boom. Yes, they have, but we're talking about statistics that are valid before the oil boom.
Now, you're the director of the Public Good Initiative at the Institute. Would you tell us a little bit about what that embodies?
Right. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance has, since our inception, which was in 1974, has been focused on the issue of scale and ownership, and specifically focused on what cities can do in terms of exercising the authority that they have to enable their citizens to have a ownership stake in their future and to generate a significant amount of their wealth, not entirely internal to their borders. We think of cities as nations, not autarkic but self-conscious. You know, nations are, except for North Korea, are not autarkic, they're not self-sufficient, but they do map the flow of resources through their borders, and they do enact laws that essentially try to maximize the good and the welfare of the people within their borders, and that's similar to the way we approach cities. We started an initiative about 3 or 4 years ago that is called the Public Good Initiative, which is somewhat broader. It deals also with the issue of scale, but it primarily focuses on the issue of the public and the private. The founding fathers, when they set up the Constitution and declared independence of Great Britain, they thought, John Adams talked about, the positive passion for the public good should always supersede the private interests. And we have a rich history in this country of doing that. I mean, the first major public institution in the United States of America is in the Constitution, was part of the cabinet for 200 years, and it's called the Post Office. And the Post Office has a rich history not only in delivering the mail. I mean, delivering the mail is certainly something that the Post Office does. But at its very inception, in 1792, Congress enacted subsidies such that the newspapers would be delivered free from city to city. And they did that because they wanted information to be broadly disseminated, and they wanted to have an informed citizen, and it worked out astonishingly well. In fact, Alex de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who is well known in American history as someone who traveled in the early part of the 19th century throughout America and took excellent notes on what the culture and what the people were like, and he said that it was an astounding thing for a Frenchman to see that in every small town in the United States at that time, there was a newspaper, and people were informed of the news. And in the late 19th century, when the package delivery, parcel delivery firms were becoming an oligopoly and they were mistreating their consumers, the post office started a parcel post. And in the early 20th century, when the banks were mistreating their customers, they started the postal banking system. So this was an institution that was a public institution that saw itself broadly as trying to honor and maximize the public good. We created the national parks. We created a decentralized, publicly owned system of libraries. We created a decentralized, publicly owned system of public education. And then in the 1930s, we, of course, expanded the concept of the public good to social insurance, like Social Security, and in the 1960s to health care, at least for the elderly. And so we have a rich tradition, but in the last 30 years, and I mean literally from 1980 on, we have begun to subordinate the public to the private. And in 2016, the word government is now a pejorative. The word public is not that far behind. And the word private is sacred. And so, you know, people now see privatization in virtually every aspect of American life, and it, in fact, has sort of colonized even our thinking. So people now think that government enterprises are inherently less efficient than private enterprises, and they see the government as being unresponsive and so on and so forth. Yeah. And so in 2013, we created this initiative to specifically address the issue of the public and the private, and to try to reclaim the narrative and trying to inform people that although everybody likes to complain about the government, it turns out that public institutions, whether it's a municipally owned utility company or a municipally owned water department, that it turns out that government can and does provide competitive and high quality services and has traditionally done that.
What would you say the key steps would be for citizens to restore and reverse this trend against public ownership in the commons?
Well, I think one thing that they can do is they can talk about it. Even among one's friends, if you talk about government or you talk about public enterprise, the immediate reaction will be, well, that doesn't work, or they can't do that, or that's corrupt, or that's inefficient, or you have civil servants who are lazy or overpaid. You will get that immediate reaction, and one needs to engage in that conversation. And if you engage in that conversation, you need to be informed. And there is a rich literature that will give you chapter and verse on the efficiencies of the public sector. But we're not only talking about public ownership, although that's an important part of it, but we're also talking about the public option in the same way that the Nonpartisan League was talking about the public option. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance works with cities to encourage them, enable them, and help them to build their own telecommunications network, high-speed fiber-based telecommunications networks. And there are about 80 cities now in the country that have citywide fiber networks, and many, many more have partial fiber networks to their schools or internal to the operations of cities. And in virtually every one of those cities, there are phone companies and cable companies that provide internet service and broadband service. And so it's a competitive environment. It's not a monopoly by the city, but every time that they establish one of those, the rates mysteriously go down precipitously. and so, you know, even if they ran at a loss, if you take into account the savings that people get from their cable bills or their phone bills, it way offsets, you know, any subsidy that might come from the taxpayers. And most of these don't have any subsidy whatsoever from the taxpayers. So I think that the public option is important. And then the other is the exercise of authority over the private sector. I mean, we have gotten to this, to the point right now where you have political parties that essentially are asking for the abolition of public authority. So I think that, I mean, there are a number of steps to be done, but it seems to me that the very first step is to reclaim the narrative, and the way to do that is for people to open their mouths and initially say, geez, I've been bombarded by my friends and I can't answer to their questions, and then to do a little research and open your mouths again.
Well, David, this has been very good. I want to thank you and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance for setting the stage to make this a receptive environment. The public banking initiative is building directly on the kind of work that you guys have done. So thanks very much for that, David.
Thank you very much for interviewing me, Walt. I appreciate the work that you've done. It's been foundational.
That's David Morris, co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Now let's connect with Ellen and her guest as they talk about a new way of devising taxation and economy based on true land values.
My guest today is Alana Hartsock, a founder and co-director of the Earth Rights Institute, the author of several books, including The Earth Belongs to Everyone, General Secretary of the International Union for Land Value Taxation, a two-time candidate for Congress in Pennsylvania, and a longtime Georgist activist. It's great to be speaking with you, Alana.
Thank you for inviting me, Ellen.
Well, I heard you speak at a Georgist conference in Newport Beach. You also invited me to speak. I was quite impressed with your presentation. I hadn't really thought much about a land value tax before that. So I thought maybe you could go into all that. We have a serious problem now with the speculators driving up the price of rents and real estate prices,
right,
especially in big cities like New York and San Francisco and London, and you all have an answer for that.
Right, and I want to mention the important interface of your work with money and those of us who have a focus on the land problem, and I feel it's very important that the two movements not only understand and appreciate and validate each other as much as possible, but also build that movement for a new economy together, because we are addressing the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. Mm-hmm. And if you look at finance, insurance, and real estate, that income is what we would call unearned income. And you see that very well in finance and banking. And we see it in land and resource ownership and control. And then since the working people have so little basic security, if you're working 30 years mortgage for your house, you pretty well want to have insurance. So there you're buying into the insurance. And insurance companies are often investing in financial and real estate instruments. So that wealth just simply gets augmented. The FIRE sector is also the number one sector that contributes to political campaigns, and that top one half of 1%. Mm-hmm. So we really look to this as major way that the wealth is concentrated. And in the work to get at the basic factors of justice, the normal, I would say, liberal left approach when we talk about wealth inequality is to claw back the wealth at the top. And the income tax had one point been able to do that, but the income tax is so much shifted onto wages, onto earned income, and off of asset ownership, off of real estate and finance asset ownership, is very difficult to effectively use the income tax anymore. Whereas a land value tax, you can't move land to offshore havens. You cannot play shell games with it. And with the incredible advances with GIS, the Geographic Information Technology, we can post and know who owns what land where and how much is it worth. And so that much of that land value, which is created by society, you mentioned New York, London, and San Francisco Bay Area, the areas where there's the most economic activity is where the wealth concentration game is most intense, and where the workers, normal working people, even high, what we might consider relatively high income professionals, are in the squeeze of having to pay more and more rent or mortgages. So the rent's going to landlords that own these valuable locations in the cities. That's an unearned income. And if you're buying, then you're paying the mortgages to the bank, sometimes well over two or three times the cost of the house you're paying just in interest payments. So that's an unearned income. That's what you're trying to get at with the public banks, so that there is no unearned income in the private sector, and banking is used as a public facility to facilitate exchange, not to extort and extract wealth from workers. So I think to fully appreciate and understand the policy of the land value tax, we have to have more people understand the land problem, Ellen.
So I can see that I need to fit the land value tax into my proposals, because one thing that I'm always arguing is that there is not enough money in the system right now, that because all money is created by banks when they make loans, effectively, and we're now in a balance sheet recession where everybody's paying off their loans instead of taking out new loans, the money supply is shrinking, and therefore we need to get more money out there. And so you could do that through the Federal Reserve, some form of quantitative easing for the people that actually gets out there into the system, or through the Treasury issuing U.S. notes or trillion-dollar coins, I've argued for. Or public banks just issuing money the way all banks do by creating more loans. And then the objection is always, well, that will create inflation if you put more money out there. But I say, no, it won't. As long as you have workers and materials in a competitive market, then if you have more demand, you will create more products. That the shoe salesman can't really raise his prices, because the shoe salesman down the street is going to just be shoes at the lower price. So what you do is you put in more orders to the manufacturer and you wind up with more shoes. But as you pointed out to me in an email, which is what actually prompted this interview, doesn't work for land, because if you have more money competing for the same amount of land or the same real estate, then it's going to drive up the price, as we're seeing. And right now we particularly have a problem because speculative money doesn't have anywhere to go. The bonds pay almost nothing, and so they're plowing into real things like real estate and stocks and gold. And
And they're looking, because of our information technology, these big funds scour the entire planet for where they can capture the unearned income from land and resources. If they see that any government maybe is becoming successful and the economy is coming together, or if there's just great land masses that are available, they will get control of them. They're doing that great land grabbing in Africa. There's public investments that they see might be going into some kind of public infrastructure. That's going to increase land value. And so the call goes out that this is ripe for speculative capture. So what you've really seen now is it's a law, actually called the law of rent. And that is, as an economy overall, there's increase in economic activity, the land values escalate more rapidly than the return to wages. Now, that pie of how the wealth is distributed between working people, your wage earner, and your land and resource owner and capital owner, factories and so on, the way that pie is distributed, there may be an overall increase in all those sectors when there's a certain boom happening. But the land sector, the land and resource, the fire sector, is increasing more rapidly as a percentage of the pie than the return to labor. But then as the pie shrinks or stabilizes, well, then the law of rent really kicks in and starts squeezing workers, and then you go into the recession. So the ideas that you're for that are very important in terms of the money system and the signage reform, yes, we should be issuing money directly as spending, as social spending. James Robertson in the UK, who is so clear about how the money and the land system work together, and Stephen Zarlingo with the American Monetary Institute is for the direct issuing of money. And you for the public banks, I mean, they're all very, very important keys in addressing the financial exploitation. Then when we combine it with the land value tax, we really have a solid third way beyond left and right. What happened in economics was that this idea was gaining a great deal of populist momentum at the end of the 1800s, moving into the 1900s in the progressive era. The labor movement was for land value tax. It was those movements were together at that point. Henry George was the one who brought forward an understanding of the law of rent and popularized it and detailed it in his magnificent Progress and Poverty book and his other work, Social Problems, Protection and Free Trade, and so on. And he became so well known that some say that he was more of a threat to the powers that be in the United States than Marx was. So the emerging schools of economics were paid by the moneyed elites to create our neoliberal economics paradigm, Ellen. This is really important for people to understand. The classical economics made a distinction between land, which was the term used for all the gifts of nature, land and labor, and then capital being wealth used to create more wealth. So those were three factors. And then how wealth was distributed in terms of the ownership of capital, the ownership of land, and those who just had their wage labor was of great concern. And you also see writings in John Smith. You see him talking about the importance of a unique form of taxes on land. What's really fascinating historically is by the time Karl Marx got to his third book, Capital Part 3, he saw that the capital monopoly came out of the land problem. And he was talking about the underincome that needed to be socialized as Adam Smith was. There's a confluence between Smith and Marx on this policy of land value taxation.
Now that you say it, I can see where taking over ownership of all the land would be one solution to that problem. But then the George's solution, I guess, is that you leave the ownership in private hands, but to the extent that it's unearned income, you tax it.
We would say it doesn't matter who has the land title. What is important is who gets the income, the rent income. Who gets that unearned income from land and natural resources? So we would say let that be the main source of finance, of public finance, because it is created by society. San Francisco, New York, London, it's everybody together working and making those valuable land sites. So it's a socially generated wealth. It belongs justly back to society. And then we would say, what is true private property? We hold that this is a labor theory of value. If you work for it through your physical or mental labor, we say that is your claim. And the government should not extract wealth from that form of private property. So therefore, we would say remove taxes from earned income, wage income, and collect this massive amount. And we're looking at 25 to 30% of GDP is this unearned income from this massive amounts of land value that's mostly privatized now. So we would gradually, we don't need to do it, we can't do it, but instrumentally, we can do it step by step till we collect more and more of this unearned income from land, the land value. And there's been, in California, in the early 1900s, they in fact put in a form of land value tax in an area that had a big land monopoly in the rural area, in the agricultural area. And it did create a land reform, and it created many healthy, vibrant communities in the Modesto Turlock area until the Bank of America kind of undermined it. But it was a functional example of how this works. my colleagues written books and looked back through 10,000 years back to the early Vedic period and Greece and China, and seen that when cultures find a way to fairly hold the land and resources, you have a harmonic, just society. When a few start controlling and amassing the land and resource base, then of course you have poverty and war and debtors' prisons and all these social problems that we see today. But that Vedic period, 10,000 years ago, it had a form of a land value tax, which was surprising when they discovered that economic history. So this is like a golden thread of truth of economic justice that keeps being rediscovered through the ages, and then battles against the forces that concentrate wealth.
Mm-hmm. It definitely sounds like a good idea if we could start from scratch and just say this is the way we're going to do it and it'll be fair and, you know, have the beehive mentality and everybody will work together. But the big issue to me is how do we get from here to there? We've already got all these monopolists who own all the, I mean, they're buying up all the water rights. It's not just land. They're buying up all sorts of resources that public needs. So how do we use it gradually?
You probably played Monopoly game. I mean, to mention that the original Monopoly game was a Quaker woman who was a Georgist who created Monopoly to show how the Monopoly was happening. But then the second stage of the game was to do land value tax. It was a Georgist teaching tool. The Monopoly is the original folk game, and that's an interesting history in itself.
So what happened to that part of the game?
Well, Clarence Darrow and the game companies got a hold of it and essentially stole the copyright and made a lot of money off of the game that this Quaker woman created that was folk game. People would make copies of the game and play it at home, and it's a fascinating story about that one, just like what happened with talking about in academics when the original factors of land, labor, capital were undermined, and we have our neoliberal two factors economic, which is what students of economics learn. It's just labor and capital. The whole land, the earth, the resources, nature created resources in neoliberal economics are a subset of capital. So you cannot make that distinction in neoliberal economics in order to get to a beyond right left fair economy. And it's just been obfuscated. The whole land section of the economy has been obscured.
How would you distinguish land from capital?
Okay, I'm going to talk about how we've been doing our property tax reform in Pennsylvania, where I live. But also there's been a number of cities. There's a book called Land Value Tax Around the World. There's other cities who've done partial implementation of land value tax, so we know it works in a good way. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we understand that our property tax is two different kinds of taxes, Ellen. It's a good one and a bad one, and it's an upside-down tax. So we want to reform the property tax, one. And we've been doing this. We have 18 cities in Pennsylvania, and the property tax has been removing their taxes, lowering and removing taxes on buildings, which means people's homes, which we consider their private property. So why fix up your house and have to pay more property taxes? There's just something wrong about that. So we lower that tax on the houses, and then we make up for it by an increase in the land value. But because most homeowners only own a little spot of land, there's a lot of land that is underutilized by a few large landholders. Those are the ones that are going to pay more. So when you start reforming the property tax that way, it's very progressive, and that the average person, that the homeowner, pays less in property tax. And because we need better and more housing stock, it gives the incentives right so that people can start building the housing that we need. If you untax the house itself, and then you also, part of what we do is to work to take taxes off of any income, local income taxes. So you increase the purchasing capacity. You're taking the land value speculation, the land hoarding, out of the land sector, so you increase affordability of land. So now you start getting labor and land able to connect to have the market work for affordable housing. Hasn't that been a big issue? How do we have affordable housing for everybody? Which we don't, which is why the banks extract more and more of this rent, the land rent, in mortgage payments. And this is a point that Michael Hudson, economist Michael Hudson, is so very clear in making, that the banks are taking the rent. And people borrow money who are playing this game. They borrow money so that they can get more property, so that they extract more rent from working people and make more unearned income. So Allentown is the third largest city in Pennsylvania, and there was a movement to have it go in this direction with this property tax to land value tax. And they had a home rule charter that was going through at the same time. So their charter was to freeze all other taxes and only enable the increase of tax, local taxes on land value. It passed. But then the few that were going to pay more, large landowners, downtown parking lots, single-level parking lots, are great land hoarders and very poor land usages. The ones that were going to pay more launched a campaign against it, so they had a revote. Well, the people again voted to move forward with this form of tax policy. And that was some years ago, so there have been benefits in Allentown to this compared to surrounding cities that have the old style of property taxes. So everywhere we've done this, we've seen that we can build our local economy by using local taxes in this way. An interface between the money system and this land value in taxes is that, say you're looking at how can a city have a viable, different kind of currency, maybe a fair kind of currency, that kind of monetary reform. Well, if a government accepts a currency for payment of taxes, that currency is quite highly validated. It becomes like real. So how we pay taxes is a reality maker in terms of the money system, if you see what I mean. If we're looking at different ways to get out from under this money system and we want to create alternative monies, if we use the land value tax and say, okay, you can pay the land value tax off in a different form of currency, we'll accept it. Well, that currency then has validity, greater validity and functionality if you can do that. And that's what they did in Germany, that you've studied, that Wurzel towns that were doing that demurrage reform with the money. So I think the first step, Ellen, is to see that there are working examples and to know that with the incredible information technology we have, to see who will pay more, who will pay less as we switch to a land value-based tax system, that this has a really practical possibility. And it is practically being implemented now. This is exactly what the powers that be don't want to have democracy, a democratic lens on the land and money system. Mm-hmm. So you might say it's the 99% versus the 1 or 1.5%. It's 99% waking up to clarity around economic justice.
Yeah, I can see the objections that the landowners will say, well, they own it, their property right. I mean, you're violating their property rights. It's unconstitutional. And then they'll present all sorts of examples of elderly people who own their house with some property, but they don't have the money to pay a tax, and that would make them lose their property.
Well, so let's address the two things you just said. One is that's the same excuse that was used around slavery. And we don't have chattel slavery, but we have wage slavery, and we have worse now. So the property rights has to be clarified. What is genuine private property and what should, by birthright, be shared from all of us? Mm-hmm. And I haven't yet met a person who's disagreed that we should have equal rights to the earth by birthright. And you mentioned the elderly people, and you are correct. That comes up. Well, simple. First of all, under a fair system, elderly people would not be poor people. Second, elderly people who are homeowners are not the poorest of the poor either. But nevertheless, we don't want to have anybody have to leave their homes if they should. And as I said, most homeowners are paying less with this. But say elderly homeowners paying more. They can choose under the system to not pay any taxes until their home is sold, till they pass away, till they move, in other words, until they actually have the income flow that will enable them to pay. So they can live there the rest of their lives, and then when their estate is sold, society recapture back the value that was created by society. So there is no reason to have any negative impact on elderly people. It can absolutely be written in.
Could you explain that again about how they're actually, most people will be paying less tax, most homeowners?
Okay. In Pennsylvania, and land values are so high in California, we really, just to work, we have to start taking off some of the income taxes that people are paying, state or federal, so that they have more purchasing capacity to pay a land value tax because the land values are so inflated in some areas. And in Pennsylvania, we have a situation where when you shift the tax off of houses and onto the land site value, the vast majority of homeowners pay less. I'm saying 85%. And the ones who pay more, it's not much more. So for number one, this is a very progressive tax for homeowners. And it starts turning the economy around and starts to create a more, like I said, the housing market, local housing market can be stimulated with this without any outside tax dollars coming in a subsidy.
So where does the big money come from then? You said that income taxes can be eliminated. So what's going to replace them if most people are going to be paying less?
Well, most people are not owning significant amounts of capital, stocks, bonds, and so on. There are wage earners who've worked for 30 years to buy a house. And so where does the money come from to replace the income tax? It's through the massive amount of unearned income.
Okay, so these would be large landowners.
Exactly. Large landowners, but those owning extremely valuable land sites. Mm-hmm. Look at these expensive cities. People living in these tiny little places and paying this high cost for rent, that's unearned income going to those who own these extreme. That's how Astor and so many of the bigger American fortunes were made, through this grabbing hold of urban land. And then,
and see how they would expect, though, that they've got their costs and they factored in, well, I'll buy this building and rent it out to people and that'll cover all my costs. And then if suddenly they have much greater costs, they could go bankrupt. They're going to protest that this was a breach of contract or whatever, you know, retroactive legislation.
Well, that, again, was a slavery thing. That was a breach of contract. When we address this fundamental inequality in our system of land and money problem, we will have these reactions from the few. But they're crying while people are in the streets and suffering and homeless and the horrors of our society. So I'm not going to have sympathy because I'm going to say, okay, sell it to your tenants. Reduce your price and your tenants will form a housing cooperative. Let go of it. If you have more wealth than you can really hold on to, just let go of it. They're still going to have plenty of wealth. People who own really big fancy houses, we're saying we're not going to tax them on their house, just on their land value. So I'm going to give you an example in Pittsburgh. There was a corporation that owned riverfront property but was just holding on to it, hoarding it, not doing anything. And that same company owned industrial land, and they were providing jobs and services and producing stuff. So when they brought in land value tax in Pittsburgh, the productive part of that corporate land were not going to have to pay more. The land speculation along the riverfront that they were holding was going to have to pay more. So it depends on whether that owner is a land speculator or whether they are actually providing goods and services. Now, provisioning of the goods and services of housing in New York and San Francisco, it's a very low percentage of the profits that they're making. I lived in San Francisco for several years, and it was during that boom period, the earlier one around 1978 to 80s and the early 80s. And I moved into a little apartment, $350 a month. 1980, it was sold. They repainted it. My rent went up to $550. A year later, it was sold. They repainted it. My rent went up another $200. I'm told that that same little apartment these days is probably over $2,000, Ellen.
Wow.
Now, it's not like they're creating great capital improvements. All they did was paint the house. Mm-hmm. They were able to get all that massive income. So these owners of these valuable properties in the cities, they are not going to lose out in their vast amount of wealth by paying a land value tax. And that's where we can actually go and see the books and see the information and see how much they're going to pay.
We can use the new technology to trace the history of who owns what and figure out exactly what they're worth. That certainly is a good argument for if people say, well, it hasn't been done for hundreds of years. Why do it now? You could say, well, we didn't really have the resources to do it before, but suddenly we can do this fairly, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely. We can have, to me, it would be the greatest game on earth. Who owns what land where? How much is it worth? Who benefits? Who loses? You know, track the money that we can. Now, another really corrupt thing that happens with property taxes is that the owners of these big corporate headquarters, the big skyscrapers, they treat those buildings as capital, right? And because capital deteriorates, they can declare a loss. So say they're given their property tax bill. They can say, oh, my building is now depreciated in value. So we're going to write off the depreciation of the value of the building to what we owe in property taxes. And they do that, and they end up paying little or no property taxes. Now, that is highly unfair. People say, oh, what's going to happen to these big skyscrapers if you take the tax off of buildings and put it onto land value? Well, they can't escape paying the land value tax because we're not dealing with the issue of capital depreciation of your building. You're just going to pay a land value tax, and the land value is extraordinarily high in these urban centers. Think of it as a gold mine or oil wells in the middle of our downtowns that's just pumping out the wealth into the pockets of the few. That's a way to think about these extremely high urban land values.
Well, it all makes good sense to me. I want to look into it even more now that you've piqued my interest even further. Thanks for illuminating all that. I just wondered, when you were talking about monopoly, it made me think of one anecdote. Somebody wrote this to me in an email. He said, 5-year-old granddaughter, he was playing Monopoly with her, and she had all the money, and he was bored with it, and he said, well, I'm out, and, you know, pushed away from the table. And so this 5-year-old, I mean, he was going to quit the game, and 5-year-old took half the money and shoved it over to his side, the point being that even a 5-year-old understands that if you want to keep the game going, you have to share the money.
Exactly. Or we all go down together.
It's great talking to you, Alana. Thank you so much for all the illuminating information. Do you have, like, websites and things you want to tell people about?
Our International Union for Land Value Taxation, so it's theiu.org, theiu.org. And then I have a website, earthrights.net, that in the publication section has my book that's actually a free PDF there. The Earth Belongs to Everybody. And then there's the Schalkenbach, S-C-H-A-L-K-E-N-B-A-C-H. Schalkenbach Foundation has all of Henry George's books in print on the whole subject of land and land value taxation. So there's a great resource with the Robert Schalkenbach Foundation. But they can join the IU.org as a free member to keep in touch with this movement.
Okay, sounds great. I've been speaking with Alana Hertzog, co-director of the Earth Rights Institute and author of The Earth Belongs to Everyone.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!